You're listening to the Mosaic Podcast, brought to you by Jewish Federation of Palm Beach County. Each episode of this podcast will offer you excerpts from the Mosaic TV news magazine, which airs Sunday from January to April in the Palm Beaches. Mosaic explores the most pressing issues facing the Jewish community here at home and around the world. And now, here's your host, Susan Shulman Pertnoy.
We're overjoyed to have as our first guest this new season the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren. Welcome to Mosaic, Michael.
Great to be here. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov. Yeah. Aside from a former ambassador, you're also a former member of Knesset, a filmmaker, an accomplished author, a historian, a professor, a columnist, a combat veteran, a father, and a grandfather.
Most importantly, a grandfather.
Well, I don't know.
Going on six now.
Going on six?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that is
most
something.
Importantly. Yeah.
Well, you've also found time to write a brand new novel, a mystery novel, To All Who Call in Truth. How did you have time to write this novel with everything you do, and what inspired you?
Well, it's called COVID.
Okay.
This is the great time giver. No, I've been writing since I was about 12. I started as a poet, a teen poet. Later on, I moved on to short fiction and then film scripts. That is rather a bizarre part of my resume where I won the PBS National Young Filmmakers Award for the best young filmmaker's film of the year, and then went off to Hollywood to work with Orson Welles for a while.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is a very strange story.
So you started off as an artist,
always.
Basically.
Oh, no, I had two different parts of me, but this is one part. You're probably not old enough to remember the Paul Mazan wine commercials.
No.
Remember? It was Orson Welles holding up the glass of wine and said, as Paul Mazan said, 100 years ago, no wine before its time.
Yes.
Well, I held the cue cards for that.
How old were you?
21.
Wow.
21. He was horrible. It was a good preparation for the Israeli army, working for him, because he was like a miserable human being who yelled and cursed. And then I went on, I kept on writing. I wrote throughout the years, many, many rejections. And I like to think that the rejections I collected, and I collected them all, were made a file that was about as thick as the old Manhattan phone book. You know, just piled up. Many novels. I published my first novel in 2000, another in 2004. This is actually my fourth work of fiction. And I have a collection of short stories that came out last year called The Night Archer, 51 stories, which I'm very fond of that book. And I have another book coming out next year, another novel coming out next year.
You talk about your Judaism in this book, and you set the book in the 1970s. Why did you choose to do that?
Two reasons. One, because the early 1970s very much evokes our current period. Those of us old enough to remember it know it was a period of profound upheaval, political upheaval, bombs going off in post office, protests on campus, a time of great uncertainty and a great sort of implosion of faith in the future of the United States of America. And so the early 1970s evokes the 2020s. Secondly, because it is set in a Jewish community, in a suburban area, much of it takes place around a conservative synagogue. The title, To All Who Call in Truth, is from Psalm 145. The Lord is near to all who call upon him, to all who call upon him in truth. It's in the Ashrei prayer, which we say four times a day. To all who call, and I think it's one of the most extraordinary lines in any religion. I think that this was written 2,900 years ago. The notion that you could approach God if you approach God in truth is just an extraordinary notion. But the early 1970s was the last moment when American Jews were a separate ethnic group. Now, it's hard to imagine this today, that Jews ate bagels. Nobody else ate bagels. Why would you? They were hard and white, and you broke your teeth on them, and Jews ate whitefish, and Jews ate lox, but nobody else did. And we had Jewish jokes that were Jewish jokes. And if you got a college application and there was the place where you put in ethnicity, you wrote Jewish.
Right.
Today, American Jews, even very Orthodox American Jews, not only do they not ask the question, how can I be American and Jewish at the same time, they don't even understand the question. They don't even understand that question. Even the people in Brooklyn, they don't understand the question. It's one of the great success stories of the American Jewish community. But in 1972, Jews were very different. But just a last point. when writing this book, there's a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism that takes place during the course of the book. And when I was writing it, I thought, well, no one's going to understand this. People are going to read this and say, you know, anti-Semitism? America doesn't have anti-Semitism. And between the time I was writing the book, the time it was published, anti-Semitism has once becoming a reality for American Jews. And
it's
everybody will understand. Everyone will understand the anti-Semitism in this book.
Absolutely. It's so current.
Yeah.
It's so current. It's really quite a... I mean, I'm three quarters through, and I don't want to... Don't tell me the end.
Okay.
I don't want the spoiler. Your dad was in the Army, and he was actually at the Battle of the Bulge.
My father landed on Normandy, he and his brother. And in the Battle of the Bulge, both of them fought very, very hard. And my father was a decorated veteran. His last award was the French Legion of Merit, and was instrumental in stopping the German offensive in December 1944. He just passed away a year ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
Did he influence you to become an Israeli soldier?
It was like this. I grew up in a very Zionist house. I grew up in a working class neighborhood in northern New Jersey. I was the only Jew on the block. And it was Sicilians. And matter of fact, Sopranos is actually shot in my hometown.
Oh.
And I knew those people. Boy, did I know those people. And they used to beat the crap out of me for being Jewish. And I'd come home all bloody. And my father would take me and show me an album that he and his brother had put together, taken in Buchenwald and Dachau. And he would open this book of the piles of the bodies and the skeletons and say, "You see that? You see that, son? That's why we need a strong state of Israel."
You can't get more powerful than
that. You can't get more
powerful
than that.
No.
And that's why I carried the pictures with me everywhere. I grew up during the period of the Six-Day War, would later write about it, as you know. And everyone remembers the miracle of the Six-Day War. People forget the 3 weeks before it, where we thought Israel was going to be destroyed again and that we were going to be witnessing a second Holocaust in one generation. And that was... I had my image of my parents sitting in front of the television and literally tearing their hair out. And,
sure.
It was amazing. That's very profound for me. So so I had that Zionist side. And sometimes they come together in stories like this. I don't always write about Jews. I don't always write about Zionism. I'm now engaged in writing my next collection of short stories. And I'm writing a series of stories called, I don't know what I'm going to call it, but what it does is it gives voices to people in the Bible who don't have voices.
Wow.
So just this week I completed a story of David told from the perspective of Bathsheba. I have the story of Exodus told by Pharaoh. I have David and Goliath told by Goliath.
That's fascinating.
That is fascinating.
It really is. That's very clever.
Yeah.
On that note, we have to take a break. We'll be right back after this brief message.
Mosaic is brought to you through the dedication of generous corporate sponsors who fueled the work of Jewish Federation of Palm Beach County. We thank American Commercial Realty, Appleby Utifrend Wealth Management, Raymond Motor Cars, Bruce Gendelman Insurance Services, Commodore, Singer, Baseman, and Braun Attorneys, First Republic Bank, Rogers Design Group, and Shapiro Pertnoy Companies.
We're back talking with Ambassador Oren, and we've been talking about your books that you've been writing. I want to switch gears a little bit to ask you about what your thoughts are on the state of American Jewry today.
Well, the state of American Jewry is like it's good news and bad news. And people tend to focus on the bad news, right, rather naturally. The bad news is the very high rate of assimilation, the alienation from Jewish identity, the alienation from Israel, often hostility to Israel. It's incumbent on Israel. I can mention here that I'm running to be the chairman of the Jewish Agency. It's incumbent on the Jewish Agency as probably the only organization that has the sort of the experience and the resources and the personnel and the outreach to actually try to bring, you know, very assimilated, particularly young American Jews, back into the fold. Not easy.
No, it isn't.
We have to rethink how we do this. We have to rethink the language we use. We have to rethink the locations we find them, because these young American Jews aren't necessarily in the synagogues and they're not necessarily in
That's
federations.
Right. That's right.
So we have to reach them with a recalibrated Zionist and Israel message. It's one that has to be very much focused on feelings, touching the heartstrings, less based on facts. Facts don't count for very much today. Alas, I'm a man
sad.
Of facts, I'm a historian, but they don't count for much. The glass half full is that the American Jewish community is at the height of its power. I remember I mentioned earlier that, you know, nobody asks whether how I can be American and Jewish at the same time today. It's a huge success story. I'm also focused on Orthodox America. It's interesting. I myself am a traditional Jew. I'm active in an Orthodox synagogue in Israel, but I've come through the Reform and Conservative movements also. I know them very, very well. As ambassador, I was instrumental in securing the Kotel arrangement. I negotiated it for about 2.5 years, very, very hard negotiations. And unfortunately, the government pulled out of it.
Yes.
But it will be restored in some measure. The last thought is that the Orthodox communities, particularly the older Orthodox communities, are expanding very rapidly in the United States. And it's important that we in Israel also engage them, because many of those communities, it's not one community, it's many communities, many of them want a closer relationship with Israel.
Yes, I'm aware of that. That is interesting. But I just have to read you the statistics from this recent poll by the Jewish Electorate Institute. And it's very, very disturbing.
I know it.
For our audience, 34% of American Jews feel that Israel's treatment of Palestinians is similar to racism in the United States. 25% feel that Israel is an apartheid state. And 22% of American respondents believe that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinians. Mm. Please address this.
Oh, shocking. It's shocking. I think we have to be cautious. The people who do these polls poll a certain segment of the American Jewish population. They tend to be urban, mostly Eastern Coast.
Liberal.
And so in that poll probably is not represented the ultra-Orthodox. Probably not represented Israeli Americans, close to 1 million of them. Probably not represented many Russian Jewish Americans. I think that would completely change the scope of that to look at that. But still, even these statistics are deeply, deeply disturbing. The most disturbing is the genocide, that there is any percentage of American Jews that think that we are putting Palestinians in ovens is outrageous. Is outrageous. So it's a wake-up call. It's a wake-up call that Israel... You know, we define ourselves by law as the nation state of the Jewish people. And that is the nation state of the Jewish people wherever they are, however they choose not to practice their Judaism. And therefore, it's morally imperative and incumbent on us to try to reach out to these people. And again, it's not easy. And I'm very realistic about it. There are processes occurring in this country in particular over which Israel has no control. We didn't create critical race theory or intersectionality or, you know, microaggressions. We didn't do that. And yet we're on the receiving end of so many of them.
Yes.
So we have to try or do our best to try to bring back from the brink whatever percentage of the American Jewish community believes that we are sticking Palestinians in ovens.
No, the PR is a nightmare. I had the privilege of being on the ground right at the ceasefire of this latest conflict.
Yeah.
And spoke to Israeli generals about how they were bombing in Gaza and how they had the knock-knock bomb to give warning to the Palestinians. And what was the media doing? It was saying that we were killing all these children and it was just a bunch of false narratives that was being displayed all over the world. And I don't know why the PR is so bad.
Because Israelis, part of Israelis have given up, especially young Israelis, and I go around the country talking about this. They'll say, listen, the world is anti-Semitic, they're going to hate us no matter what we do. You know, if we got $100, let's not invest it in public diplomacy, let's invest it in a school. And it's a very tough argument to counter, it really is. Other is people come to the military who are trained to believe that you win wars by fighting them, not by making your case on a television set. That's a hard one too. And part of it is just, sometimes just incompetence. In every war, the ones I didn't fight in, I was always very much involved in the media. And last May, I was very much involved with the media. An American Jewish organization hired a PR person to make sure I got onto all the programs.
Oh,
I got onto everything, from Morning Joe to, you know, the CNN, always. But nobody in the Israeli government was doing that. And I got no messages from the Israeli government, so I had to figure out how to explain Israel by itself. On the penultimate day of the war, we had a conversation with the prime minister. You know, what are we going to do? They were waking up 8-9 days after the beginning of the war. How, what are we going to do? By which point, it was too late.
Moving on to the BDS movement, years ago, you said that was a going to be very, very dangerous for Israel. What are your thoughts about this Ben and Jerry's ice cream situation?
Yeah, I rather presciently, unfortunately, I came back from Washington in 2000, the end of 2013, and I met with the Israeli defense establishment. I said, there's a thing called BDS, and you should know about it, and it's going to be very serious. And they sort of laughed at me, you know, BDS. The important thing is that we have tanks, and they didn't quite understand that. And that our enemy's goal, they know they really can't defeat us on the battlefield. They know it. What they can do is create a situation where we do not have the legitimacy to defend ourselves. And ultimately, we don't have the legitimacy to exist as a Jewish state. And they do it systematically. Every war, they chip away more of it and more of it and more of it. You saw what happened in May. It didn't last 8 days. Back in 2006, the second Lebanon war, it lasted 54 days. We wouldn't have 54 days today. And so that's a huge challenge. And when I was in Washington, I would tell my staff every time there was a battle going on, I said, our job is to gain time and space for the IDF. That's our goal as diplomats. Today, a very, very daunting task. The Ben and Jerry's situation is indicative of this. These are lovely Jewish guys who created this wonderful ice cream. And
they were on Mosaic, by the way.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yes.
I hope you gave them a hard time. Nobody loves Chunky Monkey, you know, more than I do. I live for this stuff. Kama Sutra, oh my God, that's the best ice cream going. I want to give them an advertising here. They're anti-Semites. And I'll explain it. It's not easy to call these nice Jewish boys anti-Semites, but they are. But of course they're anti-Semites. They're not boycotting China for sticking a million Muslims in concentration camps. They're not boycotting Russia that violates every possible human rights law. They're not boycotting Turkey for occupying Cyprus. Nothing. They're singling out one of 200 territorial disputes in the world. They're singling out one party to that dispute, and that party happens to be Jews. And they're boycotting Jews and a certain segment of Jews. That is by definition, has to be by definition, anti-Semitic.
We're going to shift gears a little bit I'm going to ask you about anti-Semitism and why you think there is a rise in anti-Semitism.
Well, there's a rise of anti-Semitism because of conditions that have given rise to anti-Semitism in the past. Insecurity, economic dislocation, a feeling of helplessness, a loss of power, particularly in the United States, a loss of power. All sorts of tensions, ethnic tensions, an atmosphere of violence, all this contributes to the rise of anti-Semitism. America's biggest problem in confronting anti-Semitism is an inability to agree on what constitutes anti-Semitism. So the British Jewish community, which has never been a particularly strong Jewish community in the way the United States is, it doesn't have the equivalent of a federation, was able to agree on a definition. And by agreeing on a definition, they were able to take down Jeremy Corbyn, as the head of the Labor Party. Very effective. The United States, I don't know if that'd be possible because there are such disagreements about what constitutes anti-Semitism. So we talked about Ben and Jerry's before. How about that front page splash of the New York Times that had the photographs of Palestinian children who were allegedly killed by the IDF last May? Now, part of the American Jewish community, and I would exclude many people I know and myself among them, would say that's fundamentally anti-Semitic. There's no pictures of the Afghan and Syrian kids killed by the American military,
right,
or any other military in the world. It's singling out Israel. So it's fundamentally anti-Semitic, but many American Jews would say, well, you know, Israel had it coming to them, and New York Times was justified in publishing those pictures. Good that they published those pictures. So if you can't agree that that's anti-Semitic, that's difficult to combat. And so the big challenge here is getting that definition.
Well, there is a unified definition that our federation,
the IRA definition, which is an excellent definition. I fully subscribe to it, but not many people do. There was recently a petition by 300 leading American Jewish scholars who took deep issue with the IRA definition, particularly around the issue of Israel, whether anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism
constitute
the same thing, and. Right. I fully, of course, believe that if you deny the right of the Jewish people to self-determination, unlike other peoples in the world, that's fundamentally anti-Semitic. If you single out Israel for special condemnation, according to a criteria that you would not apply to other states, anti-Semitic.
Switching gears now, I want to talk about Iran, which is a hotbed. You wrote that why Israel may soon attack Iran. Why do you think that might be necessary?
It might be necessary because Iran is approaching what's known as threshold capacity. That is the ability to make a nuclear weapon in short time, whether it's a matter of weeks or a matter of even days. Now, the United States, in theory, could probably live with Iran that does that. The president has said time and again that he's committed to preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, but he's not said that he's committed to preventing Iran from getting the capability to make a nuclear weapon. But for Israel, that's crucial. Were Iran to get that capacity, then we would be on constant high alert. If we wanted to respond to an attack from Hezbollah or from Hamas, they're both allies of Iran, we would have to take into consideration whether Iran would use that opportunity to break out and create a nuclear weapon. And that would greatly constrict our maneuverability and our ability to defend ourselves. So our big feel right now, as there are international negotiations going on in Vienna about the possible renewal of the 2015 nuclear deal, we are deeply fearful that the Iranians are using those talks as camouflage to move toward that capacity, the ability to make that bomb in short order. And therefore, we have to be prepared to defend ourselves, to prevent Iran from reaching that. Then the bigger question is how will Iran respond? Hezbollah has 150,000 rockets placed under 200 Lebanese villages. The estimate of the IDF for the amount of rockets we would be hitting us every day would be between 2,000 and 4,000 a day. So we'd have to operate very, very quickly to eliminate that threat. A complex, complex situation, indeed.
And Israel, of course, is always the underdog in a no-win situation. Let's end on a positive note.
I say we win by surviving, and we don't just survive. You know, a prominent American Jewish journalist once asked me, I get your tactics, I don't get your strategy. And my response was always, but our tactics are our strategy. You don't understand that. What he meant was, you know, I understand why you go to war once in a while. What's your big strategy about making peace? No, our tactics have been, and our strategy have been since 1948, is that we go to war every once in a while, and we remind our enemies that it's usually not in their interest to make war with us. And we gain time. We gain 5 years, 10 years. And during that time, we thrive, and we create Israel, while the rest of the region gets mired down and goes nowhere. And that is our strategy, to keep on earning that time until such a time that the Middle East changes. But that's sort of a rather messianic vision.
Well, Middle East is changing. Look at the Abraham Accords.
Mm-hmm. But those accords wouldn't have come about if we hadn't had the tactic, if we hadn't repelled every attack starting in 1948, if we hadn't proven it time and again that we are not going to sit there and be wiped off the map. And in fact, we're going to thrive. And why did these countries make peace with us? They made peace with us because, first of all, they realized that they weren't going to succeed with war against us. But beyond that, they realized, hey, there's tremendous benefits to being allied with this country, which is economically, scientifically, technologically, militarily off the charts. And why wouldn't you want to be allied with that, especially since we have common enemies? So, I mean, it showed that the tactics cum strategy has worked very well since 1948.
Ambassador, I so appreciate the time that you took to speak with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mosaic Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to Mosaic on your favorite streaming platform and to leave us a review. Want more? Visit jewishpb.org/mosaic, where you can access full episodes of the show. To stay connected with the Jewish community of the Palm Beaches, visit jewishpb.org or follow Jewish Federation at facebook.com/Jewish Palm Beach.